Inside the Cross Podcast.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse MLL Podcast. We are coming off of the All-Star break, and we hope that you are as well. I am joined, as always, by Kyle Devitt, and we are ramping up for the stretch run. We intentionally are recording this podcast on Friday after taking in what we kind of expected to be a good game, Chesapeake versus Boston from Annapolis on Thursday night on CBS Sports, and it ended up being better than expectations that at least I had laid out for it. Kyle, what was your opinion of this game in terms of how forward you were looking to it and the payoff that it delivered?
I mean, I had prior engagements last night. I couldn't stay for anything except the first quarter live, and you know, I shut down my Twitter. I didn't want to talk to anybody until I saw it, and of course, got spoiled by the ever-present Cannon's email of Cannon's fall too, and I was like, oh no, I didn't want to know. But that's how much I was looking forward to, is I just kind of shut down my Twitter access, which is kind of like, you know, shutting down the IV drip at times. But I thought it was a great game. I just finished watching it probably like less than an hour ago. I mean, lots of turning points, lots of lead changes, lots of physical play, great goals. Great goal to win it, great goal to tie it. It was an excellent game all around.
The Bayhawks trailing by one with about 55 seconds to go. A couple of back and forth exchanges. They're trailing 12-11 in the fourth quarter Let's just jump back to the beginning. So you saw the first quarter live. We were talking about that a little bit. It was like 1-0 with 4 minutes to go when somebody finally got on the board in the first quarter. And at that point, I think I made the comment that it's like the best Masters game I've ever seen. I guess just from a tone setting perspective, what was your opinion of how the first quarter unfolded? You know, kind of coming back after almost a 2-week break, these two teams being two of the older teams in the league, you know, what'd you attribute that slow start to?
I feel like they were feeling each other out and kind of saving something in the tank for later in the game because it was really hot. So teams will go a little slower. I didn't see a lot of quick pass, dodge, shot kind of stuff, just kind of like everybody taking open rips but not necessarily stuff that's in their wheelhouse generally from both teams, not just one or the other. And, I mean – when you think it's 2-0 and then there's a challenge, you're like, oh my God, is this going to end 1-0 in the quarter? That's crazy. And it did. So Boston goes into the second quarter up one goal. It was the slowest MLO quarter I can remember as far as goal scoring, but there was, you know, a fair share of turnovers and backups behind the net from missed shots that resulted in turnovers eventually. And, you know, when teams are feeling each other out like that, you kind of know a little bit that you're in for something pretty awesome. And that definitely was the case. I was very upset when I had to leave. But the first quarter, you know, if it's slow, it's methodical, it's just setting something up. It's building the plot, you know, it's building the plot. And there was many twists and turns throughout the story of the game.
And so the Bayhawks trail 6-3 at halftime, pick up the speed a little bit offensively with a nice burst to take the lead early in the third quarter. And then it kind of went back and forth until, as I said earlier, Cannons take a one-goal lead with about, you know, under a minute and a half left in the game. The Bayhawks ride the ball back, and then relatively ill-advised shot, save, Cannon's clear. How do you want to break down the last
35
or so seconds from
Cannons move the ball to one of their best ball carriers in Buck takes the ball to the corner, gets trapped and tripled, and tries to loft a 40-yard pass over his head to the top of the 2-point line, and to John Hayes, gets deflected, grabbed and thrown upfield for a clear.
Nice job on, I think it was Jesse Bernhardt coming up with that ground ball.
It was. It was a knockdown and then a ground ball and then an outlet to Michael Simon, who brought it across the half, called timeout, and then brings it across. And all of a sudden, you know, it's the Bayhawks game. You know, it's their game to tie. And you kind of felt like if they tied it there, they were going to win. you know, the momentum shifted that much. And a couple plays previous, there were some errant passes from Boyle, actually, which is not something you expect on the Boston side. And then, you know, Casey Powell gets the ball, tosses it to Westervelt. Westervelt's like, no, it's yours. He hands it back. Powell gets a nice little run from the side, hangs up a guy on a rub screen, and as he's falling, puts it in past Jordan Burke, far pipe. It was the stuff, you know, people write books about and sing songs of. It was awesome. It was a great, great ending.
Well, that wasn't the end.
Well, it felt like
it felt like the end for sure.
It felt like the end. I mean, I guess I kind of knew who was going to win, but even if I didn't, I feel like that was what was going to happen. And then, you know, Cannons have a chance to win it overtime, call a timeout, bad shot, gets cleared, and they get a procedure call from the box to put Chesapeake up. I mean, how many mistakes can you make? That's a lot of, that's three mistakes from two of your most dependable players. It just, if you're a Cannons fan, you're pretty upset about that game. And obviously, you know, the shot that lingers from the game, you know, obviously Westervelt gets the blast to end it, man up. But the shot that lingers and the thought that lingers with me at the end of that game is Tucker hunched over with his hands on his knees, just head down, like, how did we lose? And, you know, the Cannons beat themselves. That's how they lost. I think, not taking anything away from Chesapeake, they did a great job coming back. Do you want to talk about the third quarter goal at all? I don't want to skip over that.
Are we talking about the Grant Casey Powell goal?
Yeah.
We're going to talk to Casey Powell right now. So why don't we talk to him, and then we'll come back. We'll talk about Casey Powell, and we can talk about this goal as part of it.
All right. Sounds good.
And the Inside Lacrosse MLL podcast continues with a very special guest, the legendary Casey Powell, who made his 2013 debut last night for the Chesapeake BayHawks in a harrowing 13-12 overtime win, which has already been discussed a little bit on this podcast. And Casey, I guess, you know, just to kind of tip things off, first of all, would you say, a lot of people said that you were coming out of retirement. Is that a fair assessment of kind of how you characterized your return to the league? And I guess just generally speaking, how did it feel lacing them up and getting back on the field last night?
Well, yeah, I did send a letter to Inside Lacrosse last year to retire from the league, but I had a pretty good indoor season, and Coach Cottle picked me up in the supplemental draft, and a lot of the older vets that I played with, and Spallina and Polanco and Grant, have been after me for the past several months to join the team, and my commitment's ended, and I decided to get back in action, and last night was a great start.
Casey, it's Kyle. How you doing, man?
Good, Kyle.
Just, you know, I think to follow up on that, why did you come back after you decided kind of it was over last year? What else changed besides, you know, having a good season and these guys kind of hunting you down?
You know, it's maybe I shouldn't have retired, and maybe I never will. You know, as of doing that, that was kind of a knee jerk reaction, I guess, to some happenings last year. But you know, as I get older, I wanna leave lacrosse with no regrets. I've had the opportunity to play for a very long time and at a very high level. And it's in my blood, and it's something I really enjoy to do. I love to compete. I love to contribute, being part of a team. The Chesapeake BayHawks have a lot of great players on the team, and I always like going to a new team and trying to fit in. I can play both midfield and attack, I had thought I was going to play attack for the BayHawks, but I came into practice on Tuesday and Wednesday, and then Coach was running me at midfield, so that was fine with me. But I think one of the reasons I've been able to play for so long is because I can play multiple positions and do different things out there. So it kind of says, you know, something about what, you know, working on my skills over all these years and being able to put them to use in certain situations. But I felt young again last night. You never know what you got in the tank. I haven't played field lacrosse since last year's All-Star game in Boca Raton. And, you know, obviously as I get older, I start to question myself and, you know, if I wondered if my legs would be there, especially with the heat last night, but, I felt really good, kind of surprisingly to me, being out there, just is a great feeling. It was an awesome crowd. The, Chesapeake Bay Hawk organization welcomed me in and, did a little tubing in the Chesapeake Bay behind a boat, had a nice crab feast, and hung out with some of the veterans and some of the younger guys. So it's just great to have an opportunity to play, and it was a fun night last night, no doubt about it.
Casey, I was watching the game from the comfort of my air-conditioned family room, and I got to say, it was really fun to watch. It was interesting how the pace of the game kind of progressed a little bit. You know, I think, you know, the first game after the All-Star break, these two teams, the fact that these two teams sit in the standings, the stakes were going to be high. But, you know, through the first quarter when it, you know, kind of emerged as a little bit of a defensive slugfest, I kind of felt like it was, you know, it had the feel of kind of like the San Antonio Spurs playing the San Antonio Spurs insofar as, you know, there was a huge emphasis on doing the right thing, not making mistakes, being fundamentally sound. And, you know, it almost seemed like guys were taking a little bit of time, getting their legs under them before you started to see some of those really phenomenal athletic plays, particularly offensively, that did start to come down the stretch. What was your sense of just kind of, you mentioned obviously the vibe of getting used to this team, et cetera, but just kind of the How did last night's game, the fact that it went to overtime, compare to your memories and experiences of a standard MLL regular season game?
Well, the MLL games are all a bit different, and you know, you just kind of got to feel your way out. But we knew the importance of the game, especially in the standings, and we knew that Boston was on a hot streak, and we knew that it was a must-win situation. So I think we came out a little tight in the first half, only scoring 3 goals. We forced a lot of shots. We dodged and shot right away. And, you know, but defensively we did a good job. We only let up 6 goals. And obviously we only put in 3 in the first half, so that was disappointing. So we had a lot to talk about at halftime from the offensive standpoint. And we came out in the third quarter, and I think we scored 4 or 5 right off the bat. We talked about getting the ball around and getting the ball on everybody's stick and getting in touch and moving the defense. So that's kind of what we did. And then basically we just fought it out. You know, so it was a really big win for us. Just a great crowd. And, you know, obviously winning in that fashion is a great feeling, and hopefully we can ride some momentum going into next week's game.
Casey, the Bayhawks are known as one of the top franchises in almost all aspects in the league currently. What has been your experience with them in relation to them picking you up from that day to last night playing with them for the first time compared to the rest of your experience in the MLL?
Well, there's a lot of great people involved in the organization with the management and Coach Cottle and Spencer Ford did a great job. It was kind of hectic for me. I had to come in and get a physical and do a couple of concussion testings and get in 2 practices before last night's game. But it's a great organization. It's obviously great to play at the Naval Academy. It's a beautiful town in Annapolis, and you know, there was over 8,000 fans last night. So it's great to see. For the league to have that kind of success, and it was great for me. They treated me really well, just in terms of making sure I was all set with everything, and you know, in terms of being a good organization, it's the little things that make a big difference, and you know, just showing up at the airport and having a car service ready for you and bringing you to all it brought me to all my appointments. And it takes the worry and the strain of that travel and going into a new team and meeting new people and new players. It makes it a lot easier. But the guys welcomed me. It's great. I feel respected by a lot of the younger guys. They, you know, came up and introduced themselves and shook my hands. And obviously I've played with and against some of the other veterans. But a great bunch of guys all the way around. And it was a great start for me as part of the Bayhawks.
Case, you mentioned some of those vets and certainly, you know, Junior is one that stands out. I think I spoke to him in the off season, and you know, he made a comment about just wanting to get in the opportunity to play field lacrosse to you. You know, last night kind of showed that maybe there might be a little bit of magic there with a jaw-dropping 2-man game goal from behind. And then also, you know, obviously, you mentioned just the measure of respect. Certainly that seemed to be the case with the coaching staff deciding that coming out of a timeout with 17 seconds to go, down one, they were going to put the ball in your stick. Can you just talk about those two plays in particular? And I understand that it might be difficult to describe. It's kind of like asking Picasso why he put an eyeball in one spot. But at the same time, I'm just curious as to what your thoughts are on those two plays that, you know, for all intents and purposes, decided the outcome of the game.
Well, I had to learn a new offense right away. We had practice Tuesday and Wednesday night. And again, I wasn't sure until the game started what position I was going to play. But I learned the offense. The guys talked me through it. It was pretty standard. And, I have a lot of respect for John Grant. I love playing with him. He's a great guy on and off the field. And, he's one of the reasons that I wanted to come back and play. I think he has the best stick in the history of lacrosse. He's a fierce competitor and somebody that, I really enjoy going to battle with, and somebody, as you could tell last night, I like to work with out there on the field. We kind of talked about, me inverting and using the two-man game, and we set it up perfectly. I kind of backside picked. I got in the junior's defenseman's blind spot and picked him pretty good, and then I just rolled kind of a slip pick to the goal from behind, and I just had my stick out, and the ball just landed in there. So it was just a great pass, and obviously I look forward to working with him more, and I think you'll see more of that.
And he threw that behind the back, right?
He did, yeah, and I didn't move my stick. It just landed in there. So it was a great pass, and I was like, "Hey, look what I got here!" And I was right in perfect position as I caught it, and I believe Farrell tried to catch it rather than throw a check, and he missed the pass, and it landed in my stick, and I was able to, I believe, stick it 5-4 on the goalie on Burke. But and then at the end of the game, obviously I was playing pretty well. I didn't make a lot of mistakes. I think I had two turnovers on a couple forced feeds late in the game. But I always wanted the ball in my stick. I felt very confident in doing so. And Kyle Dixon came and said a great pick there at the end. And I was fortunate when I got kind of cross-checked up high that I was able to, when I fell, keep the ball in my stick. And I just popped up and I saw a little bit of an open lane. It happened really quickly, and I didn't see the ball go in. My face was smushed in the ground, but my teammates bum rushed me, so it's always a great feeling. And then the roar of the crowd, I knew it went in. So gave ourselves the chance there to win it, and then obviously Drew finished it there at the end with a beautiful hitch move. So it was awesome and a great start, and a couple of big plays to seal the deal.
Not to take the focus completely off of you, but sort of for a second, I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask if there were any other pals maybe coming out of retirement anytime soon, if we might see, you know, Ryan or Mikey playing for Bernarge and Placid, something like that. Just your thoughts on that, and, you know, just kind of your comeback in general. You kind of said earlier, like, you might never retire. I think a lot of people would be happy about that.
Well, I can't speak for Ryan and Mike. I know they're out west right now working lacrosse camps and doing a tour, I believe 6 or 7 West Coast camps, and they're doing a fantastic job with that and running Rhino Lacrosse. We had an awesome tournament in Saratoga, New York, where the three of us got together, and we had 80 teams, and it was just great to get my brothers back together. My whole family was there working, but those guys, I can't tell you if they'll come back and play, but they're certainly a big part of the game, the Grain Ambassadors, and I'm certainly a proud brother to have those guys in my family. You know, their accomplishments on the field, but more importantly, the accomplishments off the field. So I certainly would love to see them come back and play in any respect, and I love the opportunity we do have, whether it be Placid or Vail or Hawaii in October or so, you know, something like that. But yeah, we'll be playing, but I'm not sure that they'll be coming back at the professional level.
And Casey, I just want to get you out on this question. One of the things that this MLL season is a little bit about for Richie Mead, Dave Petromala, Jeff Tambroni, and a couple of the other guys involved in the U.S. national team staff is kind of this evaluative look at the 2014 world team. And, you know, don't want to say that you were necessarily ever out of the conversation, but anybody that watched last night's game has to think that, you know, maybe Casey's got a spot on this team. Did you apply, and is this something that you're thinking maybe could be in your future plans to try out for the U.S. team for 2014?
Well, I certainly would want to be on the team, but I have applied for 3 different events in the past year, and I've gotten an email sent back that basically said thanks anyway. So I'm not sure that I'm in the plans of the U.S. coaching staff and the committee, but you know, I would love an opportunity to try out if I'm playing well and healthy. It's my greatest honor to put that USA jersey on, and I still have a bitter feeling in my stomach from 2006. I feel like you know, that was a letdown, and I certainly would love an opportunity to represent the United States and try to hang on to that gold medal that my brother Ryan won in 2010. But I'm gonna train hard and try to get ready for tryouts. If I do get an opportunity, I would love it.
Excellent. Well, as somebody who was able to be around that team in 2010, you know, it was so clear the role that Ryan played and the role that anybody with an experience and skill set like you would bring to that team. You know, over the last 3 tournaments, it's been incredibly clear that it's about building a team, not just trying to build, you know, the best assembly of talent that you can. And I think that, you know, like I said, a guy with your experience and that can fill that type of role, seems like almost a no-brainer to me. So, best of luck in that endeavor, and certainly one that I'll be keeping an eye on. And obviously, best of luck the rest of this MLS season. It's great to have you back.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for all you guys do, and look forward to seeing you down the road here.
You're the man, Casey. I appreciate it.
Thanks, fellas.
So, Kyle, I know before we gave Casey a call, butterflies? You had a little bit of butterflies to talk to him? Is that fair to say? I don't want to call you out.
No, there are only 2 players that get me nervous. And thankfully, one of them's retired, and it's Connor Gill. But Casey's the other one, man. I just, you know, legend status. I've told a lot of stories about my, you know, personal encounters with him, meeting him for the first time as just some punk kid in the audience at like a demo he was doing in New Hampshire. And it was, you know, it's like one of those things that you remember for the rest of your life. You know, one of my prized possessions is a signed Casey Powell poster to me that hangs above, you know, my desk in my office. It's kind of cool. You know, it's cool that he's still in the game too. You know, I really appreciate that. And one of the things that is great from that interview is he's like, well, I don't know if I'll ever retire, and I'd be fine with that. I don't know about you. I'd be cool with that.
Yeah. I can't imagine why anybody would complain about that one, but, yeah, it's funny. I've gotten to know, you know, a lot of lacrosse players just in over the capacity of doing this job. And I will say that the thing that's most endearing about Casey to me is, you know, I wouldn't say I know him well, but he's like pranked me like 3 times, not prank call, just, you know, pulled different pranks on me. And that's the type of thing that, you know, as long as you like somebody, that's the type of thing that you never forget, particularly when it's a legend that does it to you. So, really awesome, like you said, to have him, back in the game, and really awesome to get him on the phone talking about what was an incredible performance last night. And I think that, you know, as we kind of hopefully continue to see him progress over the course of the season, the one thing that'll be so interesting for me to watch is that in the second quarter, as it's, you know, he started to get on the field a little bit more, make a little bit more of an impact, and you started to realize that 22 was Casey Powell. It wasn't, you know, just somebody wearing number 22. I thought that he looked incredibly bouncy and athletic, and for a guy that I think is either 37 or 38, you know, the spring that he had in his step was really remarkable, and I'm curious to see whether or not he thinks that can hold up over the course of the next 5, 6, 7 games.
Well, I think, you know, when you get older, you approach things with time, and when you know that you have time to heal, and maybe you can't take a 14-game season, but maybe you can win, you know, be a part of a winning team for 6 games or 5 games, that's really, you know, something you have to take into account. He's playing a shortened season. I don't think it's an accident that he wasn't there on opening day. I'm sure there was a lot of personal stuff that he had going on, but I'm also positive that it's better for him to be playing now than it would be for him to be finishing up game 11. Do you know what I mean? I feel like that's a big part of that.
Absolutely, but that's the other thing too, is that, like, it's important, I think, to figure out what context to put his performance, you know, 3 goals and an assist, and it seemed like every single one of them was highlight worthy. you know, what context do you put that into? I don't want to sit here and say that he doesn't do that if he doesn't have those types of fresh legs. But at the same time, you know, it's hard for me to say that he does. So I guess, you know, whatever. None of that matters nearly as much as the fact that it's when you put him next to a guy like John Grant, who Casey just said he thinks has the best stick in the history of lacrosse, which is one of those things that I think you want to actually sit down and think about, but I'm not sure that there are many counter arguments to come up with. The potential for jaw-dropping plays is off the charts, and we saw a few of them last night, and if that's the best thing that comes from this, as opposed to, you know, maybe a Bayhawks run to a third championship in four seasons, that's a pretty good thing to come from it.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure the Bayhawks would take the championship, and I think that's why they brought him back, but, you know, it's how you approach how you're going to win. So one of the side effects of having Powell in the lineup is, you know, something that we don't talk about that often because it, you know, like I say, destroys the veil, perhaps, is that, you know, guys, Michael Kimmel and Polanco were healthy scratches for the game due to salary cap reasons, you know, and people didn't really talk about that during the broadcast. They usually don't unless it's Clint. He's the only one that really talks about that. But those two guys have been part of the team for a long time. I mean, who do you go through a rotating base of guys that don't play to let Powell play? I don't even want to question the fairness of that. I don't think that's even up for debate. I think it's just a personnel decision. I don't know. I think Cottle definitely has a plan, and you know, he looked like a genius last night bringing Casey in and having Casey score the tying goal to send it to OT. So, you know, it all depends on who you're putting your trust in, you know, and the Bayhawks have shown that as an organization, you know, maybe they deserve a little bit more respect than even people like me are giving them.
So let's open up the lens on this a little bit. With about a minute to go, it looked like we were going to have two teams at 6-5 at the bottom of the playoff charts with a little bit of separation from Charlotte, Rochester, and New York, currently sitting at 4-6, 4-6, and 3-7, respectively. The fact that Boston lost drops to 5-6. Chesapeake seems to be comfortably in the playoffs almost, you know, basically just need to win one of their final three games, probably, in order to secure a playoff bid. How do you kind of see this shaping up from the perspective of the Bayhawks being a title contender as opposed to a playoff contender, and Boston being able to hold off the three teams that are either a game or two games behind him?
Well, I think everybody's trying to not be the fourth team, because if you're the fourth team, you're playing Denver. And
I think that argument is so overrated. Not just because of the Outlaws, you know, history and championship weekend, but just because of the history of championship weekend. It's not a foregone conclusion that the top two seeds make it to the championship game, which means that if you finish third or fourth, you know, history says you're going to be in pretty decent shape.
I'm not talking about history. I'm talking about the juggernaut that is the Outlaws.
Okay, well, I'm not ready to jump on board to that degree either.
You're not.
No, I think that the reason that I'm at least marginally skeptical of them being the reason that I think they're so good is the same reason why I don't think they're unbeatable. And that is because they don't rely on some of the things that make great teams. They rely on a lot of the things that is within a coach and a managerial control to make sure the team is consistently good. And that's what they've been. They don't make mistakes, but they don't necessarily. I don't know, man. I feel like they're capable of having an off day in a way that if they were built a little bit differently, particularly in terms of their offensive prowess, they probably wouldn't be. But I will concede that a good portion of the reason that I feel that way is because some of their offense that has been so impressive in the first half of the season, or the first 10 games, is a little bit, you know, it doesn't have a 5-year proven track record. It has a year and a half or so proven track record. And so I'm not saying, you know, I'm not ready to concede that those guys are definitely going to perform on the championship weekend stage the way they had over the course of the season.
Well, I think that's I don't agree with that. And one of the reasons that I don't agree with that is I think this is a totally different approach and collection of players that it doesn't even matter what uniform they're wearing. And I think that the MLL is so singular in that a change in attitude and a change in culture can affect you to the degree that has made Denver dominant. When was the last time someone gave Denver a game? This season. Not last season, this season. Who has given Denver a test? Can you remember?
I mean, no, but that's the other thing too, is that like, why does last season not count?
It's a totally different team.
No, it's not. It's a significantly different team, but it is not a totally different team. They still
wise, it's not different. It's not that different. The way they play is completely different. The way they play is completely different.
They're not playing a different sport.
No, they're not playing a different.
So define or explain in clear terms why the way they're playing is completely different.
There's zero reliance on a star. That's how it's different. There's no reliance on Mundorf. Mundorf's points come from within the system of the players that the coaches are running. Okay, so nothing is built around anyone. And I think that that's why they've been so successful. And how they blow teams out is the pace at which they play. They play the fast break, like no mistake, they play fast break, no mistake, shoot the ball, back the ball up, do everything fundamental on offense. And defensively, they play tight to the cylinder, tight to the crease. They let teams get mid-range and distance shots, and they pack the middle. You know, the team that's most similar to Denver is actually Hamilton. But Hamilton doesn't have, you know, the horses that the Outlaws have offensively. They have a lot of slow guys on attack. They slow the game down. Denver only slows the game down on defense and dictates the entire pace of the game. Every game they're in, they dictate the pace of the game. And that's why I think they're so good, is because they make you play their style. That no one, they don't go down and play down to any team at all. Any team at all. The only team that's really given them a game has been Chesapeake. And that was like 4 weeks ago.
Right.
3 weeks ago.
Yeah, and that was the game I was going to point to. And I think that, I don't know, I think to a small degree at least, we're arguing kind of the same thing. I'm not saying that they have been challenged this year, and I'm not saying that they, I am saying that they are borderline great because of the fact that they are so consistent week to week. That is probably like you say, they're not relying on a star. I think their biggest strength against my fear that they have an off game in them, is that they have the capacity to rely on a star. They have a star that they can rely on for the end of shot clock situations, end of game situations, who has proven, and that's a really huge asset. You know, it's that LeBron James type player at the end of games in Brendan Mundorf. And there's value in not having had to utilize him extensively to this point in the season. The thing that is disconcerting is that his championship weekend performance is part and parcel of the Outlaws' championship weekend performance generally. Now, granted, it has been weird. Last year, he broke his ankle in pregame warmups. All I'm saying is that I disagree with the notion that avoiding fourth place is as substantial as. I don't think anybody's saying that it's more important to avoid the fourth place spot than it is to make the playoffs. But it seems like that's where the conversation is headed, because it's a little bit more, I don't know, incendiary to make this point about, oh my God, if you get the fourth place, you know, if you get the fourth spot in the playoffs, you might as well not well show up. Well, you know, here you are. You're basically, now we're in a four-team race where nobody's going to, between the Cannons, the Hounds, the Lizards, and the Rattlers, nobody's going to catch the Bayhawks. It's not a conversation. So those four teams just want to stay alive. And so they've already, to the degree that which that they have postseason hopes, they already have their sights set on the Outlaws. So I hope that now, given last night's result, we can move on from that and, you know, focus on this four team, which, you know, depending on how the Lizards play this weekend, could quickly become three team run to the stretch.
Well, that's kind of what I went into with my column this week is, you know, I listed those three teams, Chesapeake, Hamilton, and Denver as, you know, the contenders. And the only team I had a doubt about was Chesapeake, and they kind of smashed that doubt into tiny little pieces last night. So you're right. There are, I don't think there's four. I think there's three. I think there's no way the Wizards make a four-game run and everyone else bombs out. I just don't think it's going to happen. Just given watching them all season and watching their opponents that they have all season, I don't think that's going to happen. I think this Boston loss definitely opens up the door a little bit more for Charlotte and Rochester. Rochester only has one home game left, so I think they're kind of at a disadvantage. And I think depending on how Charlotte does, you know, this week in that game that they have, it's going to be a big difference in how everything shakes out, you know. And they have the advantage too of playing at home against New York and effectively eliminating New York. So Charlotte has the most to gain this week now after as of the result of this past game. Charlotte has the most to gain. So if Charlotte beats New York at home, you know, they own the tiebreaker over New York. They, you know, don't have the tiebreaker over Boston, but they're in a better position, even though they have the same record as the Cannons, because they have an easier game in week 12 against Ohio than Boston does. So, I mean, it's a week by week thing. Don't get me wrong, but I just think it's three teams, and it's a matter of, do you look at the history of those teams, or do you look at the history of those teams this season to determine what they're going to do? And I think the one team that stands out is Charlotte, but the one weakness Charlotte has is they haven't been able to step on the neck, to finish people. And they have to finish people, you know? And if they can't finish New York this week, then we're having a whole other conversation next week. So all of these dominoes have yet to fall. But this first one is Boston losing to Chesapeake, and that's going to start an effect that's going to ripple out through the rest of the last 4 weeks.
So what are some of the other, you know, I've been watching ESPN all week, and they've been talking about baseball second half storylines, and it's, you know, Chris Davis, the Pittsburgh Pirates, Yasiel Puig. What are some of the other storylines that you're going to pay attention to over the next 4 weeks of the MLB season?
I really want to see if Rochester can get it together and kind of become cohesive. I have my doubts. I've been pretty vocal about it. I love to make fun of Rochester almost as much as I love to make fun of Boston, just because the fans get so upset, and it's just fun. It just opens itself up for jokes. But all joking aside, I really hope that, you know, Rochester puts it together for Matt Strebel's sake. And I can imagine, I haven't really written about this extensively, but I think it's going to happen. I can imagine a world where, like, Matt Strebel and Ryan Boyle are coaches in the MLL in the not too distant future, you know, and this might be the year to send guys like that out, you know, in style. Like I said, Rochester has the toughest road to hoe up against them. You know, they have Denver this week in its final home game. Then they go to New York, and New York definitely wants vengeance for their loss a couple weeks ago. And then they play Chesapeake and Boston to close out the season. That's not a great run. That's not a great run at all. And there are no easy games in the MLL. Blah 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 blah. But that's a tough schedule, no matter who you are. And Rochester can't afford to do what they've done all season, which is play great 1 week, play like crap the next week. Can't do it. If you do that, you're not going to make the playoffs. And I don't know what's going to happen. They're so unpredictable. The most unpredictable team in the league, I think. Just in terms of what's going to show up today. Who's coming to play today? What are they going to do? They've come from behind against teams. They've lost to teams they shouldn't have lost to. They've hung with champions. It's, you never know what you're going to get with Rochester. And that's kind of what makes them exciting, but also something you can't really count on.
I don't disagree. I think that I'm interested to see which direction Rochester turns. It almost feels like at some point, you know, it's going to have to turn in a positive direction. It just feels like since 09 or 08, they've had too many bad breaks, you know, for one franchise. The other thing I'm interested in keeping an eye on, and you know, I'm an Ohio guy and I'm unabashed in that regard. So, you know, I'm going to be a little bit more invested in a 1-19 than I probably should be, but really curious to see what, you know, what this coaching change can yield, heading into next season, because, you know, with so many young guys, so much talent, you want to see, I think, steady improvement that keeps the players engaged, because there is a fear. I have this fear, and I'm not sure whether or not it's justified, that if they become disengaged, maybe their MLL careers aren't as long as they should be. And I like the nucleus that they have, and I think that not only with a little bit more cohesion, you know, other teams that are older seeing some players either diminish in quality or retire, you know, maybe Ohio can, as they expect to, build towards the future. But I think that, you know, Bear Davis's relationship with this squad and his ability to engender their respect and improve the product on the field yields not only dividends off the field in terms of getting more fans in the seats, but also, you know, making sure that the young talent can stay together. And also, you know, if some of those guys end up putting together good late season runs, maybe they can, you know, if they belong somewhere else, turn them into pieces that'll be beneficial in other aspects of kind of building a team out there in North Central Ohio. But aside from that, you know, Kyle, they posted the top scorers during the broadcast last night, and, you know, obviously Paul Rabel leads the way. Kevin Crowley's season is well documented, and his his being a part of the MVP conversation, you know, is at least a year season familiar, a season old. The MVP race his role in the MVP race that I'm going to be most interested in as it develops is Chris Bocklet. What's your thoughts on the possibility that Chris Bocklet is going to get serious MVP buzz over the next month?
I think he's in a similar position to what Matt Posgay was in a couple years ago, where people were like, oh, well, all he does is finish the ball. All he does is score goals. Yeah, that's important. So you shouldn't disrespect that. I think that's going to be the question, and that's going to be the doubt in people's minds about his, you know, his contribution to his team and his team's success. I think with Posgay, obviously the team success definitely catapulted him to the top to get that MVP award. And I think that might happen with Bocklet as well. But I think because the one thing that is kind of like an X factor is that Posgay was a established veteran, you know, very respected around the league, and Bocklet's kind of a young buck. And I think that actually works against him in a lot of ways, just with how voting might shake out, how teams might finish. I think him being the leading scorer and the leading goal scorer on the best team should say a lot, but I think there are other factors that people are going to take into account when they do their voting and they do their, you know, they look at the teams. And I mean, people are going to say he's a system guy, he's all that. I don't really necessarily believe in that. I think if you score goals, you score goals. It doesn't matter how you score goals. I think the other side of that argument is, you know, Rabel and Crowley create their goals. You know, they go and get their goals. They go and get them themselves. And I think maybe he might lose votes to a guy on his own team in Mundorf as well. So is he in the talk? Sure. Sure he is. And if he's not, and if you say he's not, you're wrong. He should be up there in the top three in the discussion. And if he's, you know, he just needs to be. He's a good player. He's had an amazing season. His team is amazing. How can you not consider him? So insofar as your point of, is he in the conversation? He's 100% in the conversation. Now, going back to what you're saying about Ohio, I actually think Ohio's going to steal one this season in their last four games. I think they've got a good chance to steal something from somebody, even if it's someone like New York in the last game, just to get that revenge. You know, just to get that little stick in the back. And I think that they have the ability to do it now. I think that the Ohio machine team of the first 6, 7, 8 games is not even close to this team. This team is much better. It's much more, you know, friendly with the ball, shall we say. A lot less black holes on the field, dodging in circles, doing nothing. That's kind of gone. And those guys have not played for Bear Davis that did that in the previous couple games. So I think looking at their collection of talent, you're absolutely right, and to be hopeful of the future, but I think that they can actually steal maybe even two games in the last four games and kind of give a little respectability to to their season in their second year.
Well, Kyle, before we get out of here, any anything you want to wrap on? Shout-outs, perhaps?
Well, we never really got back to that junior thing. So one of the controversies of the Boston-Chesapeake game from last night was there was a 2 seconds left on the clock. There was a violation. X helmet fell off. I guess you get called for your helmet falling off, even though it happened to Rand earlier and they didn't call it on him. And he went off, and there's 2.1 seconds left. And I believe it was Ehrman or Bernhardt picked up the ball and chucked it downfield from half field. The ball bounces. Junior catches it, turns, and shoots. And there's zeros on the clock before the ball comes out. That's kind of inconclusive. That's kind of conclusive proof. Sorry. Just watching it 3, 4, 5 times in the broadcast, rewinding it, watching it myself. The goal shouldn't have counted. The referees on the field called it and said it counted. And the controversy comes in whether or not a challenge flag was thrown from Boston. They can't challenge that. That's not part of the rules. A challenge is not able to be applied at the end of a quarter or anything that has to do with time. It's only did the ball go in and is there time left on the clock. You can't challenge something that happens at the end of a dead ball. So the refs go back and we come back from break and the refs are reviewing it. And you're like, why are they reviewing it? You can't do that. The refs overturn the call on the field, which, by the way, they should have gotten right the first time. And, you know, the bottom line is the result is correct, but the way that it was reached was incorrect and erroneous, in my opinion. Do your job better the first time and make sure that it's not called a goal, because it avoids all the confusion. It avoids all the debate. That people are still talking about this on Twitter today. People are like complaining about it. The ball has to come out of the stick before the clock hits zero. If the ball comes out of the stick from half field or like the other end of the field and it bounces into the net and there's zeros on the clock, and as long as it gets released from the stick, it's a goal. But if it's not and it's still in the stick, you can't call it a goal. And I think two wrongs in this instance made a right, but I don't think that's good enough. And I think that this needs to be addressed by the league and by the officials kind of in a more direct manner than just ignoring it, which is what the league has done today.
Well, when you say two wrongs don't make a right insofar as they are not as good as one right making a right, would you rather have had it happen that the goal had stood because they hadn't been allowed to review it at the end of the quarter?
No. No, of course not.
So what would you like the league to say?
Maybe explain the rule, because it appears that
wouldn't the league essentially have to say, as far as we understand the rule, the refs misinterpreted or misapplied the rules? So yeah. Essentially, the question is like, should the MLL be in a position where they have to throw their refs under the bus, and in order to stop people from complaining about it on Twitter when in actuality, they would be shedding a light on what is probably a bad rule, that being that you can't review after time expires.
Yep.
Plus the fact that the proper outcome was reached. It almost seems like, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, this is like a little bit of like, you know, sweeping it under the rug, cover up, etc. So I'm not, you know, I like to advocate for truth. But on the other hand, I don't see the upside of clarifying this if I'm the league.
The upside of clarifying it is that you can't, everyone knows that you can't throw a challenge flag at the end of the expiration of a time period. That's important, because that's going to come up again. That's not a thing that sometimes doesn't happen. That will happen in the next, what are there, like 20 games left? That's going to happen. It has to happen at some point, that some coach is going to get it in his head that he saw it on this game and they did it in this game. And then if the challenge is denied, he's going to be like, well, you did it in this game. Now he has – an argument. Whereas before, or if you come out after this and clarify, the argument is not applicable. So I really think...
Well, that's presuming that the coaches pay attention to a statement being released as opposed to a game that they watched on TV and had a very clear memory burned into their heads. Well,
the coaches should do their job. So I don't agree with that. They should be up on all rules. And obviously the MLL will never, ever, ever, ever throw the referees under the bus, because the MLL needs these referees more than they need the players. in their mind, not in my mind, but in their mind, and that'll never happen. But clarification of a rule would be nice. That's all I'm saying. It would clear up further controversy that could, you know, result in a worse situation than the one that transpired last night. That's all I'm saying. So, you know.
Is that the note that we're going to end on?
I mean, you know, I have to do a shout out, and I got to be honest. I know I've already done a movie shout out, but have you seen Pacific Rim? Because that movie is awesome.
Of course not. What kind of a question is that?
Monsters versus robots? Are you serious? It's like the greatest thing that's ever happened. It was amazing. Go see it. If you like monsters and robots, go see Pacific Rim. You're welcome.
I don't even know what to say to that. I feel like I don't like monsters and robots.
Oh, well, you're too highbrow then. I'm sorry. You don't have the base level instinct.
I mean, if they're telling jokes, I'm probably a lot more in than I am if they're, you know, battling each other.
You know,
there are a couple things that could get me to Pacific Rim. Stringer Bell is definitely one of them.
Stringer Bell is phenomenal.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did he do? Did he carry things?
Real good. Had a nice little Independence Day speech at the end. Pulled a little Bill Pullman at the end there. It was real good. Real good. Taste of it in the trailer. Goosebumps in the theater. Goosebumps in the theater. I'm telling you.
All right, so Stringer Bell gets the shout-out this week.
Stringer Bell and Pacific Rim.
Idris Elba. I wonder if he's a lacrosse fan. I doubt it. He's British, so.
Yeah, he's British.
He's probably really disappointed that the English women's national team fell at the hands of the U.S.
French.
Today.
Well, they lost to France, too. 3-0. That's why they got knocked out of the Euros.
There you go.
What up?
All right, Kyle Devitt.
Women's soccer college.
No, not women's soccer. Women's lax.
Oh, well, women's soccer, they lost in the Euros to France 3-0.
Wow. Dropping all kinds of knowledge to end the show.
I'm all connected.
All right, we're out.
Peace.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Is that like a Pavlovian response? If somebody says we're out, you respond with peace. I feel like that's not just a you thing. It's an everybody thing.
Yeah, that's pretty much, you know, that's white boy response, man. I don't know what else to tell you.